Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Wherever you are in the world, welcome to the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss the weekly meditations, though not necessarily reaching any conclusions. I'm your host, Cyrus Polisbon, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins, Anne Dudek, and Nicholas Sarian. Welcome, everybody. Today's quote of the week that we're going to cover is by Mary Shelley from Frankenstein, and it reads, "Invention, it must be humbly admitted, does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos." Again, a little shorter. Invention does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos. Zohar, will you kick us off with that?
I just love it when people are like, to be humble. It's one of those things that is self-canceling on some level. Well, on some level is another sort of throwaway line. It's a qualifier, right? So I was caught up on the, it must be humbly admitted, also just the passive voice construction, like, by whom? You know what I mean? It's a first person statement, and then they kind of disassociate from their own statement because it's like too oracular to just say it straight up. Right? Invention is from chaos, not from void. You could have just said that. But then I thought more deeply about it. Why must it be humbly admitted? And I think it has to do with the fact that we're talking about humans creating something spectacular, which is an act of hubris and potentially arrogance. And when you think about a theological tradition that posits God as the creator and all creation is divine in some way, whenever a human being engages in creation, there's a way in which it has to be recalibrated back to us, to a baseline of humility, lest we think that we're gods. So perhaps what Shelley is suggesting is that there's a humble difference between divine creation, which is creation ex nihilo, and human creation, which is creation of something from something. I think the more radical read is that even divine creation is creation of something from something. But that was a topic of great debate in the Middle Ages. Aristotle thought that all creation was, I believe, creation of something from something, that there was an aspect of the universe that was always there, eternal, and there was a material substrate, whereas the Christian tradition imagines that, and also the medieval Jewish and Arabic traditions imagine that even matter has to be fabricated.
In the beginning, there was God.
I mean, in the beginning, there was something. And what is even the beginning? Like, the Genesis 1 is translated as "in the beginning" by the King James. But the grammatical construction in Hebrew actually isn't "in the beginning." It's "in the beginning of God's creating heaven and earth, dot, dot, dot." So in English, we think of it as there was this moment called the beginning and something happened then. Whereas in the original, there is no real beginning. You're just kind of thrown into it and it's the beginning of. So you're already in the process. And that begs the question of is there even such a thing as an origin moment? Is there even such a thing as something there at the beginning or before the beginning? And that's where sort of the mythologists go wild.
I'm going from memory, but doesn't it say also like that God moved over the, this is me digging into my memory, moved over the surface of the waters or whatever.
The spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep.
Of the deep.
All was wild and waste, tovo. I guess in English it gets translated as tohu bohu, which I'm... If memory serves me, is even though that describes the physiological or geographic terrain, ends up becoming a literary term for like a person who's not right in the head. So we're talking about like chaos, this physical thing, like, you know, a messy room, so to say. Right? In the beginning was a messy room.
In the beginning was chaos.
And God was like, you know what? I think I'm gonna put a sock drawer over here. Call that the first day. Second day will be for shirts, third day for pants, fourth day for ties, fifth day for you know, trinkets.
I like the idea that God started with socks. Like, he hasn't created heavens and earth yet. He hasn't created humanity, but he's like, we got to have a sock drawer.
Definitely.
Yeah, start from the bottom.
I think the point is there's a psychological analog to all of this, which is the creation of mental order out of mental chaos. And so just as you could create a cosmos that would, and by the way, in Greek, cosmos means order as well, which is awesome because Stuart's got a company called Cosmos, which is about knowledge management. So well named. But there's also a way in which the mind is super cluttered, and having a real thought or having an identity is a way of kind of making order from that chaos. Like Nietzsche, I'll be quiet in a second, but Nietzsche imagined a human mind as, quote, a parliament of drives, which was his way of saying that we're actually much more disordered than we think. We're all on some level mentally ill, mentally imbalanced. We don't really have one driver calling the shots. There's no CEO moving us along, sort of commanding the SVPs to go and do his bidding. Instead, we're just a bunch of values clustering together to form a coalition until some other cluster within us revolts. And so that if you take that as the view, then creation is almost like self-creation. It's ordering yourself in the midst of chaos, but you never actually overcome the chaos. You never actually get to unify the parliament of drives. You just get momentary wins.
Yeah. Management of urges is you're always being pulled at least in two different directions. I feel like, so interesting that you went into a conversation about order because it's not present in the quote. But it is something that was very much in my head when I was mulling it over, as well.
Same vibe, like just being a designer and an architect, like the idea of creation, obviously like daily, you know, activity, creation and invention for people in this field. And I think that it's also like there's kind of a current obsession, I think, with like there are no new ideas, like there's no new design, there's no new this. And on some level, I think that this quote sort of represents that, like there isn't, right? We're not creating out of a void. Like we have so many inputs in ourselves, to your point, Zohar, and then in the world. But I think like what I view is invention and design is like a reinterpretation on how to order chaos. And so like there's always a new lens and a new way to order things, right? And we're just kind of constantly taking a look at chaos and saying like, what if we stack it this way? And what if we order it that way? And for me, that's like really what the design process is in a nutshell. And I think it's especially like Mary Shelley saying this quote and writing Frankenstein and literally making kind of a human being, even though that's allegorical. I feel like I can't get that out of my head too.
Mm. How do you think about when you're the making of the human being? Like obviously Shelley, she's writing about a man creating a man, which is atypical, but like women have been making babies for a long time and no one's like, oh wow, that's, look at that artificial intelligence you just popped out, you know. do you have a take on sort of the irony or the disjunction between the unnatural way that man is being made in the novel and then the identity of the author who actually has this organic way of bringing life into the world?
Yeah, I don't want to make general statements, so I guess I can only, I'll speak for myself. So I'm a cisgendered female and I identify as female. And I think that from a very young age, you just understand that like with very little external input, you could create a human life, right? And I think like that, and I won't say this, but for me, the way that manifested was like, I have a very secure attachment style to my creation because creation is so like inherently within me that I don't find it a stretch to make a building. I don't find it a stretch to make a piece of jewelry or a piece of furniture. Like creation is just like a fundamental part of my being. And I've always sort of understood that kind of biologically, which related to how I view like my professional accomplishments even. And I think that sometimes like I see, again, not a blanket statement, but I see like a very anxious attachment style to men and the things that they create. And like, they're so afraid it's going to vanish, or like the ability to create is going to vanish or something like that, that I kind of like think that that's how I interpret like men kind of like, or Dr. Frankenstein creating his monster. It's like, he's afraid of his own idea of creation. The creation is afraid of him. Like there's just like this very like anxious attachment style to everything that's being created in the novel.
I love that. That reminds me of the famous meme, you know, men would rather do X than go to therapy.
So, yeah.
men would love, would rather, you know, build large language models than go to therapy. Right?
Go to therapy.
I just saw that comment used for a video that was mocking nature documentaries. It's just a bunch of guys pushing their heads first through the sand like baby seals, you know. So I immediately pictured that Zohar.
You know, it's interesting because in ancient mythology, the chaos is actually figured in very sort of vivid ways. It isn't just this abstraction. So for example, chaos could be represented by the sea or by sea monsters, or if Francis were here, we'd say dragons, at least in the West. And so there's a certain personality to them, but also women are often associated with chaos. Obviously, it depends on the culture you're in, but it's just kind of interesting. You have in Greek mythology, Dionysus is the figure of, let's say, disorder, and Apollo is the figure of order. But it seems like every culture has a tendency to think about the relationship between order and disorder not as abstractions, but almost as like personality types with some kind of gender overlay. It may not be consistent across cultures, but it's still pretty interesting.
Well, they do have Eris as the goddess of discord. Mm. Not the app, not the app guys, but anyways, they do have that female figure. They also, you know, they have Night is also female, Nyx, and Tethys, the deep, you know, these like very dark, but also all encompassing elements, elemental concepts, being female. The earth is female, where all life rises from, all creation. Earth is the next chain in the creation.
Yeah, like when you read Hesiod's lineage. When you read Hesiod's Theogony, and it's like basically like Theogony means the birth of God, which is like also kind of a shocking image. We don't really think about it. We're just like, oh yeah, you know, Theogony, like the beginning of the world. But it's like, no, this is the Gani from is related to Genesis. It's the generations of the gods. And all of them are like hyper personified. So I think, you know, we're so secular, we have a hard time relating to one God, let alone many. But the ancients were just going wild, taking every abstraction and returning it to this idea of actually having a personality. So I think that's kind of maybe helps us get into the frame of Mary Shelley, of this creation of something from something, when we think about the creative process as almost a process of like little mini gods going at it with one another in some way. Again, I'm just, for the record, I'm not a pagan, but I find a lot of poetic opportunity in that.
I thought it was really cool. I mean, very insightful, and the way you mentioned your relationship to your creations and mm-hmm. and pointing out your observations of men and their creations, and I can't help feel a little bit seen. But I thought it was really interesting because when Zohar switched to the Greek tradition, I immediately thought of Zeus. Well, in some versions of the tale, like Prometheus is the one who like creates man, but it's as I understand it, a kind of a commission from Zeus to like create beings. And so Zeus provides the, you know, he spits, his spit is the water that Prometheus mixes with the mud of the earth, and he creates mankind, but he does it for, you know, for Zeus, and they are, you know, what they are. They're not, they don't have fire yet. And that's the missing ingredient, is that like free will of that spark of intelligence. And Zeus is like, no, they're perfect the way they are. Like, don't touch them. Like if they have that, then they'll just go crazy. And of course, Prometheus, meaning foresight, is the one who like sees ahead to the greatness of man and their destiny. And so he gives it to them, and Zeus is furious. You know, he's ruined his creation. He's ruined the perfect. This is not what I wanted, you know, and he chains it to a rock to be tortured. But I was just curious if that story of like the creator being, you know, very controlling, is that in other traditions as well? Nico or Zohar or Anne?
I can have a go at this one. I think the Prometheus myth is not so much about the creation of man, but about the creation of, let's say, quote unquote, the human condition. Because what happens, I mean, quote unquote, because I guess the correct Greek term will be andros, or for that matter, anthropos, anthropology, anthropomorphism. So that means to be below something. The point is that when Prometheus gives fire to men, Zeus casts out the men from the realm of the gods. There wasn't any, let's say, I mean, men were not gods, but they were not below. They would eat with the gods in the same table. The funny thing about this, the myth is that once they get the fire, and there's different types of fire also, that's in the myth, because there's the fire of lightning, which is Zeus's fire, you know, and then there's the fire that Prometheus, in a sense, produces, which is by stealing the fire from Zeus, you know, and that's a different type of fire that is used for cooking. So the whole point is that once men or anthropos become, let's say those beings become under the gods, as being cast out from the realm or from the, I would say, the table of the gods more than the realm, because it's really a myth about cooking, eating, sacrifice, these things. They need, the condition that they gain upon, or that they're cast onto, is, I don't know the concrete Greek term here, but it's hunger. So like people were not hungry before, and they're made hungry. And it's interesting how like by gaining fire, you also become hungry. So cooking becomes a technique, because I mean, this is not much to do with the quote, but there's a famous French philosopher that passed away 2 years ago, who would be actually very good for us because he talks about technology and techniques. His name is Bernard Stiegler, and he has a book called Techniques in Time. He's a Heideggerian, and he uses his myth to talk about technology, because fire is the first form of technology, if you think about it. But to go back to the question of this type of, let's say, this mythology, if this is a mythology, so what is a mythology? Is a, let's call it an archetypical narrative that gets repeated throughout different cultures. I don't know. because like I immediately think of other creation myths, and I think there's like two, there's this, like normally what I see is that when you're talking about origins or beginnings or, you know, the Genesis stories, what you have a lot of the time is, and this is the one I like a lot, and I think Zohar will have a lot to say about this also, is that there is this absolute, no? There's no differentiation, no? We call that God. And then because of some reason, that, and that's the big question, why does this happen? That God needs to recognize himself as a God, let's say, or as an absolute. But he is the whole, right? So you cannot have recognition when there's only one. So in order for that to happen, he must, like, well, and then here you have, like, a lot of philosophy talking about this. It either needs to split or it needs to negate itself. And that's the really the philosophical one. It must withdraw. I think in the Kabbalistic tradition, this is called the Tzimtzum, no, Zohar?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's many different versions of Tzimtzum, many different accounts. There's the most radical is what's called Lurianic Kabbalah, which imagines creation as a tragedy or a catastrophe. So the moment that God creates the world, something in God's self breaks. The act of creation breaks the creator. The world that results is not the world that God intends, but is the world that occurs in spite of God. Quite strange. Certainly not what they teach you in Sunday school. And then the history that it unfolds, the life that unfolds for us, is one in which we are tasked with picking up
the pieces
and putting them back together again. This is called tikkun, which means healing or repair. It sort of got bastardized into tikkun olam, which is like the one Hebrew phrase that most secular people know and totally abuse. but actually the idea is that the sort of divine light was too powerful for this world. So even though the world was meant to contain the light, if the best way to think about it is like almost like the world is a glass, like a wine glass, and God's light just like overheated the glass and shattered the glass. And now we have these shards. That is our world. And these shards have fragments of light in them, fragments of the original divine, but they also have what's called klipa, which is shell, which is the demonic, which entraps the light and, so to say, keeps that light from finding the other pieces of light and unifying. And so the task of the human is to liberate these pieces of light and bring back God to God's self. That's even more complex than that. But that's one of the tellings. There's a more sort of classical version, which is less catastrophic, which is simply that God is infinite, the world is finite. The finite world cannot accommodate the infinite, and therefore, because God wants to create the world and wants to make a home for God's self in the world, God has to retract in order to become a visitor in this world. And so creation involves the retraction of God. And I think, like, again, if theological terms are not your love language, maybe another way to put it is, imagine you're at a retreat and there's 100 people in the room and you have so much to say, but you don't just talk at everybody the entire time, hopefully, because you want to make sure that other people can hear what you have to say and can also contribute. So now imagine that one of those 100 people in the room was God. It's like part of us is like, dude, everybody shut up. Like, God's here. Listen to God. But God's like, oh, you know what? They taught me that I need to have emotional intelligence and like listen to everyone and nod along. I'm like, yes, yeah, that's great. and so God only gets his 1 minute. to introduce himself and say where he's from, because, you know, everyone else needs a turn as well. So that's, I think, another way to think about Tsum Tsum is like God giving the universe a turn, even though it's inferior. It's polite.
I think what's striking right. about that is that, like, part of it is that there's a sense of loss with creation, right? Like, and whether that be like, because we're human and we can only conceive of it this way, but it's the same thing in design, like, you know, and the phrase, like, you, what is it? You have to like break a few eggs to make an omelet. Like, there's always a pairing of destruction of something in order to create something new. And like hearing us talk about all these different creation theologies and myths, like that keeps ringing in my mind that they all, like, there's a loss of something.
Right. What I was going to, my problem there is that I don't know, but I guess I believe that in order for you to have quote unquote creation, you need surplus. Otherwise you don't get creation. I mean, this kind of counters another form of thinking that in order for you, let's say, to go back to the theological, not to pull it back to that, but just to, since Zohar was talking about it, that there is a way of like, of seeing that, let's say, loss that happens in creation, as you say, Anne, as emerging from a, I mean, I would say desire. So like, it's funny. So like, okay, I'm getting mixed up here, but the idea being that out of, let's say, a wanton desire for something, and in the search for that, no, something gets created by the exhaustion of that desire also. So,
so I mean, is it more of like a state change than I'm a putting loss it, then? Like, because yeah, it's sort of like energy state change.
I was gonna say like it's like an orgasm. That's my way of understanding.
Why do you always make it rated R, dude?
Zohar just throws up his hands like, come on.
Yeah, it was going there. That's why I was like.
Now we know why you're hesitating.
There's a refraction period. You know, you get the climax, but there's a refractory period after.
Isn't when you think of chaos, does your mind go to a surplus? Because when I think of chaos, I just picture something that's in surplus, not in scarcity. You know, it's too much, and that's why it's chaos.
Right, but that would be surplus. So, like, I mean, this goes into like a talk on economics, but like the idea being that the only way you have surplus is if you have, let's call it overstock. We cannot fully stock energy or whatever form of unit you're stocking. So it becomes overabundant. And that's where you have surplus, yeah.
But can we replace chaos in the Mary Shelley quote with overabundance because its counterpoint is not order but void, meaning right. nothing?
I don't think there is a... I mean, this was one thing that I noticed after I read after I saw the meditation, I think yesterday, is like, is there a difference between the void and chaos? Or, I mean, I guess people like picture them differently. The void is just kind of nothing. Like, the void there is pointing to what we were discussing when we started this, which is like the creatio ex nihilo. So like the creation out of nothing. And I think chaos is more like, I mean, hence the picture, right? That's why I, you know, it's like you're not there, like with nothing there, and you're painting. It's like it's good, it's crazy around you, right? The void can be that also.
If we think about the sea, which is actually in mythology one of the original images of both the void and chaos, it really does have both, right? So the sea has this endlessness. You can't, if you're at sea, you can't see dry land. It's quite unnerving, right? And that's recorded in so much literature, is the sense of being lost at sea. But the sea isn't just this flat thing that's monotonous. Like, there's there's the turbulence of the sea as well. And there's all the creatures that live in the sea that are super creepy. And also the aspect of them being unknown. So if you like now, you know, we have catalogs of all the sea creatures and you can watch Planet Earth and marvel at them. But imagine you're like an ancient sailor and you're seeing a whale and all you know about it is mythology, or a shark or whatever it is, or you see a coral reef. It's like overwhelming. So I think you have the chaos aspect is our taxonomy historically hasn't been very good, very developed. And so you see all of these things at sea and you're like, what even is this? Anyone who's gone snorkeling or scuba diving knows that there's sort of a depth to the sea as well that suggests a certain chaos beneath the surface. But then you also have the void that holds all of that, which is, you know, all oceans are the same. And it feels like just this one sprawling mass of water. And so what's that all about? And then, of course, like if you think about the creation myth in Genesis again, it's the creation of land from water. So we don't imagine that in the beginning there was land and water. We imagine in the beginning there was just water. And God removed some of that water to make dry land.
In the Egyptian myth as well, there's just the waters of night, and then the first Temtem stone like rises up.
It's almost like land is minimalism.
It's almost like life arose from the oceans. That's wild. That's
how do they know that? They didn't read Darwin.
It's crazy. Amazing.
I mean, the other point in Genesis is separation is an act of creation. So in the beginning, there's sort of one giant mush. And there's different ways to think about creation. One is like you produced something that didn't exist before. But the more original form of creation is you actually just separating out the elements and saying, this goes there, this goes there. And so like the formation of the difference between heaven and earth, for example. It's not that God creates heaven and earth. It's that God creates the difference between heaven and earth.
I was going to say resembles the alchemical process, because gold comes out of, let's say, putrefaction. So, I mean, I'm not going to make it rated R again, but like you need to... You know, you need to look for the feces, you know, in order to get the gold, no? And that's where, and through various processes of like dissolution, calcination, putrefaction, and all of that, like you reach the stages of like of separating and purifying the elements, no? What I find interesting is that, I mean, if you can extract some sort of the creation story of theogony from looking at alchemical manuscripts, is that they don't start with like, oh, it's brown and now it's gold. They log everything in the middle. So I think to point to the fact that like everything is always in a state of creation and in flux, and like each stage is marvelous in sense. Solvi coagula. Yeah.
I wanted to point out something that the quote actually does say: invention does not consist in creating out of void but out of chaos. It's using creation in the quote, but it's using it as the verb of invention. So invention being a specific creation, do we think that's and has any interpretable value or comment? Is she just trying to say creation and then couldn't figure out a different word? Or is invention imply a intellectual aspect to it, therefore requiring order? Zohar's quote about
That's says a lot to this idea of separating, right? Because, you know, we say things like, oh, invented you know, like radon or neon or something like that. It's like they discovered it. Like they, you know, like especially in like scientific fields, like you're sort of not like inventing things, you're discovering things. And to me, that speaks to like what Nico and Zohar were talking about, is this idea of distinction and separating out, and therefore like making it into a scientific theory from kind of the chaos that it existed in before. But you're not making a thing. You're essentially discovering it and ordering it.
Yeah.
There's a... Okay.
I was going to ask Anne a question. But go ahead.
Okay.
I'm glad that stirred some stuff up, guys. Yeah, lay in.
More chaos to order.
I was going to say identity is difference, hence the famous synthesis of Hegel, I would say. People say that.
famous. In my world, I'm right. Famous.
Right. You know. No, a lot of people, when they try and synthesize the philosophy of Hegel, they say, oh, there's this thing where like identity is difference. And what does that mean is that in order for you to have identity, you need differentiation. There is no, and it's kind of a paradox,
yeah.
Because we think of difference as being the opposite of identity, no? And that goes back to the alchemy stuff, but like that's a different story.
I wanted to point out that in the Hebrew and Jewish tradition, separation is linked with holiness. So the word kadesh or kadosh, which means holy or sanctified, actually means set apart. Interestingly enough, like many things that you would expect to be holy are called kodesh. The Sabbath day, for example, set apart from the other days because it's a day of rest. Objects which are donated to the temple for use only in the temple are called holy objects. But holiness could refer to anything that's set aside. It doesn't only have to be set aside for a sacred purpose. Like there's a certain almost anthropological meaning to being set aside, which is just set aside from everyday use, everyday experience. So like I believe one of the words for a prostitute in the Hebrew Bible is a kadesha, not because that was considered holy, but simply because it was considered marginal to everyday life. So interesting that if separation is a principle of invention or creation and also comes to mean holiness, then you're always, what are you separating between? Well, from a biblical framework, you're always separating between the ordinary and the extraordinary. And so the extraordinary becomes the holy. The extraordinary, typically, if you were to cluster the meanings, ordinary things are useful things, and extraordinary things are things that you typically behold, but you don't use. And so if we fast forward 3,000 years and we come to art, art that involves objects, for example, Duchamp's urinal. A urinal is a ordinary thing, but when you put it in the MoMA, it becomes an extraordinary thing. And the difference is in the first, you use the urinal and you don't think about it. And the other, you behold and contemplate the object, not as something that you use, but as art. So people disagree on what art is, but I think there's perhaps a through line from the creation of the world to the separation of things as holy, to this idea that art is some realm in which we are not just using the world, but beholding the world. And that is one of the more extraordinary ways that we interact with our environment. Curious what Anne thinks about that.
I think that's beautiful, Zohar. That's what I think.
But what about...
Can I ask a question?
Performative.
Yeah. You just did.
The transformative part?
I said, what about art that is performative that you do, you know? that you...
You mean like performance art?
Yes. Because that's... You're...
Well, like, I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of... Like, do you guys know Vito Acconci?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, he's just a New York famous artist from the 70s, I think, New York. Yeah. I mean, what's useful in a guy? I mean, this is the performance. What is the utility in a guy? Sorry for this, rated R, masturbating under a set of wooden chairs in a museum. You know, what is the utility of that?
To remind us of how depraved we are.
As soon as Nico said his name, I was like, I know what he's going to reference, because it's like one of the most famous pieces of performance art, and I just like held my breath waiting for Zohar's look of disappointment as Nico said it. Nico, if I can give a more mundane example, which I think is going to get your point.
Okay.
So in the MoMA, which is a museum in New York for modern art, there's a big staircase. And before the renovation, it was one of the main ways to make it to the gallery floor. So it was a feature, like everyone walked up the staircase. And even though architecturally it was quite stunning, it still was viewed as like a through path, right? Get up the stairs, go to the galleries, and your destination is there. And at MoMA, they had a performance artist who would slowly, like over the course of like 3 hours, roll down the stairs. So her body was in all of these like positions for like increments of like 10 minutes, I think. And then she would make her way down the stairs. And so what it did is, as you were walking up the stairs, you really started to see them. Like, you were very cognizant of the staircase because she, through her performance, was bringing it to your attention. And I think in the way that Zohar just said, like, you were beholding the staircase, right? Not as a means or a utility, but now as a space that can create art and as a thing that was a part of art. Mm. In this performance moment. And so I think, to me, performance art actually has a lot of the same value, where it's about beholding an experience that changes your perception or makes you more aware of certain things. And you can look at dance, ballet, you know, opera. These things all, I think, function in some of the same ways in creating that experience for people.
Hmm. Yeah.
Is that Nico? Is that about what you were
saying?
I mean,
no, it's not the. No. I'm actually. I was thinking of a lot of things there, but like the last thing was that if you wanna, let's say, I'm trying to say this in the least technical way. So, if your phone breaks down, no. Then when your phone breaks down, you realize, let's say, the being of your phone. No, because it's lost all of its usefulness. So you realize how I mean, its place in the world. It's kind of difficult to put into words, right?
When Verizon cuts off my service, I simply hold the object and I say, "Ah, it's a tool."
Yeah, that's the next down.
I get it.
Thus, philosophy was born.
I think it's more like anxiety. You get more anxiety. Like, I mean, I have to send my computer to Apple for repair, and they told me it's going to take up to 5 days, and I'm like, what am I going to do?
This is the philosopher speaking. Yeah. Geez, we're doomed.
Okay, so I have a question. So Shelley, sorry, not Shelley, the inventor in Frankenstein.
Dr.
Frankenstein. Creates a life.
Frankenstein.
Creates a life. Now, you can read that through the lens of technology and say he created a tool. you can also read it through the lens of art and say he expressed something true about the world. There are many, many things which are both artistic and technological. But if we go with my idea that art is that which sets aside for contemplation and technology is that which is useful, there seems to be a trade-off. It's not to say that, say an iPad can't be beautifully designed, but I wouldn't call it art because the purpose is its function, its use function, as opposed to like to make us contemplate the meaning of connectivity or something like this. Is the life that is formed a technology, or is it a work of art?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And I will make the question more provocative. Take Elon Musk.
Do we have to? No,
we do. We do. Because I enjoy provocation.
I was thinking about Adam.
So let's take Elon Musk. I think the normal median person looks at his rocket ships or his cars and says, those are technological breakthroughs. Those are inventions. But there's Elon Musk, the personality, who buys Twitter and posts all kinds of stuff on as memes and basically trolls people, who has a certain persona. You could argue that Elon Musk is a performance artist, not a technologist, and that the real essence of his rockets and his cars is a kind of entertainment value, and it just so happened that they allow us to have better internet in rural parts of the world, or to, you know, save energy at the gas pump or whatever, but that it's actually, he's made his life a work of art, and that's what Nietzsche says we should do. And we categorically misunderstand Musk by separating the personality, however abrasive, from the creation. So the reason why I connect that to the previous question is just whether we should decide on whether our lens for thinking about something should be the artistic lens or the technological lens when we think about invention.
I mean, I have a quick thought on this that I don't think answers it completely, but in my own personal view, technology is neutral and art is never neutral. And I think for me, I see technology as the way it's utilized assigns some sort of like tilt to the seesaw. But to me, technology is almost like a true neutral, and art is always like on the side of being provocative.
But provocative doesn't seem provocative. I thought you were going to say. So when you say art is on the side of being provocative and therefore not neutral, how do you distinguish good art from bad art? Like, do you think about good?
In this case, I don't. I think most art, good or bad, is provocative.
Okay. So anything that succeeds in provoking, whether we like it or agree with it, if it does that thing, if it does that provocation, then we call it art. And technology is not.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just it's just like.
Yeah, Nika.
No, I was first gonna say that, like, for the Greeks, because like I think we are, let's say, hitching on like a few things that I'm maintaining explicit. But for the Greeks, there was no distinction between technology and art; it was the same thing. I mean, the word was techne, which is where the term technology is derived, and you can still see it happening in German, because Kunst is the term for art as well. But my point, I think where Zohar is trying to get to is that to what extent is it, let's say it's a subjective capacity, no, versus a purely objective one, no. Hence, like, the art is not in the world, but in the making of the world, by the, you know, with the subject involved. I had a different take on the whole thing in any way, because my whole point is I think it's a very good, let's say it's a very interesting puzzle to say, well, is creation a tool or a work of art? No, I mean, and you, if you contextualize that question in different periods or traditions, I think it can be answered differently. But I think we have an itch, or we have a problem, let's say us moderns, if we can call ourselves that.
Speak for
with
yourself.
Utility.
Some of us moderns. Yeah. Me, I'm a primitive.
Yeah, yeah, us moderns. No, it's like utility, like the utility of everything. I mean, there's always this, you know, popping up all the time. Am I being productive? This goes back to what we were talking about a few times ago. Or am I being productive? Is this useful? Is this taking me somewhere? Like, what's the goal here? You know? And I think the question is more like, where does that come from? Versus like, because a work of art is, yeah, it's contemplation. It's Kantian aesthetics. Like, it's not supposed to serve any purpose or meaning. That's the whole point of what makes art art, no? Art for art's sake, for that matter. But what happens when it doesn't have a sake? Or to go to Elon's example, I mean, I get it, like, it looks very useful and like, oh, we're like, this is more efficient, whatever, but who knows really at the end of the day, right? So it looks nice, and I like the car. I drove two Teslas, and they're nice, you know, they're nice cars.
putting that on the website as a testimonial. Yeah, they're nice.
They're nice cars. Nico.
The rockets are cool, you know.
I had a thought listening to you guys. Isn't art still fulfilling? Isn't it still have a function if it is satisfying that part of our mind that is non-survival based? Like, it's still fulfilling a need.
Yeah.
Like, brushing my teeth is fulfilling a need, and laughing is fulfilling a need. Eating is fulfilling a need, and taking a moment to just sit back and reflect is fulfilling a need. Maybe not one I knew I had or was conscious of, or my body below, you know, was aware of, but couldn't you argue that no, it is actually all functional, and maybe that's why the ancients or the Greeks didn't differentiate between it, and why we still sometimes use art for things that are not artistry, like the art of war, or the culinary arts. What do you think about that?
I agree that the function of art is to do something to our experience, and that it either succeeds or fails to achieve this end, whatever we think it is. So yes, everything is functional, but in my own experience, there has to be an element of non-utility or wastefulness to art. It's interesting. Nico was talking about surplus before. I'm going to go the opposite route here and say, like, what defined an ancient sacrifice? On some level, waste. Pouring out wine to the gods. It's like, why wouldn't you drink the wine? Like, that's good wine. Someone worked hard for that. You look at Cain and Abel. Abel gave the best of his flock. Cain only gave his fruits, but he didn't give the best fruits. And like, the Bible makes a whole big to-do about this. It's like they both sacrificed something, they both wasted, but one was willing to waste even more. Like, you know, one person gave $1,000 to charity. Again, you can think about charity as having utility. So, but think about it almost as if you donate to something that is, I don't know, trying to think of what would be non-utilitarian that isn't going to offend somebody. I wanna make sure that elephants have like more organic grass fed food. So I'm gonna, you know, I'm donating to the cause of giving them like tastier meals. They shouldn't just.
I have a question on that too, though, and I think this is for Nico and Zohar because they would know the answer to it. But I think like the idea of functionality as it relates to like humanity has changed dramatically, like post-industrial revolution. So I also would want to understand like how the Greeks viewed like humanity as a function, yeah, or like what is our function as individuals, like, because I think that baseline is very, very different, yeah, from us moderns, and therefore like the distinction, yeah, between, you know, art and functionality was like had a baseline core different relationship. That's a gut feeling, so I kind of want to pose it as a question.
I can take a crack at it and then I'll pass it to Nico. So I'm gonna give you, I'll respond for the Greeks and then for the Hebrews, Athens and Jerusalem. The great Greek tragedies and Seder plays were performed in a political context in which there was a huge ceremony before the plays were even performed, and there would be a march or a parade in which the soldiers returning from war would be part of this parade, and they'd be celebrated as war heroes. And in that context, there was the function of art was political. It was, of course, to offer an experience of catharsis, but also to, in some sense, create alignment for the community. So you'd go, and not only would you watch this play and feel an experience, but you'd feel a sense of unity with the other people in the stadium watching the play. And that would shore up your sense of patriotism. I think that is one of the things that has really changed, not just because of the Industrial Revolution, but because of just nationalism and liberalism and democracy, is that it's like, unless you're super fascist, in the modern era, art doesn't play that role of bringing the nation together. But pre, let's say, 20th century, like the task of the artist or the task of the poet was to actually speak for the entire nation. And Whitman actually, when he's writing his poetry, it's super American and super patriotic, and he's speaking for all people, but he's really speaking for all Americans. Whether he succeeds or fails at this endeavor, like, people can, you know, criticize and say, well, he didn't mention this group or whatever, but he's like trying to almost unify the collective. So I think that that is definitely one of the fundamental tasks of art, is not just to give the individual an experience, but to almost mirror to the collective what its identity is. In the biblical tradition, if I think about like the most famous example of art, it's the tabernacle and the temple. And there the purpose is largely to create something that feels like a sanctuary. And you could argue, if you read it through this political lens, that the purpose of the sanctuary is less the religious experience and more the sense of the unity of the community as well. So I think art once served a political purpose, and in more modern times, we have kind of softened that expectation from art. Art might be able to speak to a particular community in a political way, but it can't speak for the collective as a whole, or very rarely does. In fact, it's highly, highly polarizing. Like, you like Warhol, I hate Warhol. You like the guy with the chairs doing his obscenity, like, I think it's everything that's wrong. But there was a time when artists...
That's why we have those big blockbuster,
yeah,
pieces that are very simple, you know, yeah, appealing.
That's a great point. So maybe Star Wars or Marvel, or, you know, some of those kinds of, maybe that's the better successor then to the, you know, Aeschylus and Sophocles, if we want to think about art purely functionally.
Yeah.
I was going to say The Simpsons. I mean, this is funny because, like, when I had my first aesthetics class when I was like 21 in college or whatever, like, the professor always used to say, like, The Simpsons, that's art, you know. They there's this thing with The Simpsons in Argentina also. I don't know what would be the, yeah, like South Park, you know, or what's the other one?
Seinfeld.
Well, right, I mean, you get my point, you know. You get the point, you know. Yeah, Family Guy. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
I don't get the point. I don't really get the point. Like I get that that many people love this stuff and feel connected, but I think the scale of it is just never reaches what, let's say, a Holderlin or like a National or like a Neruda was able to achieve. Like these are basically cult classics. Ben Lerner in his book The Hatred of Poetry talks about how we expect a poem to be the poem, like the be all end all, the thing that reveals to us what is poetry, and it always fails. And so we love poems, but we actually hate poetry. And what the job of the modern poem is almost to remind us of the gap between what we want the poem to do and then the reality of the poem not being able to do it. And I think one aspect of that is the fact that once upon a time, or so we imagine, a poem really could be the exact thing that the entire collective needed to hear. And now it's like, at best, it goes viral on Twitter.
Well, we have memes today, no?
Yeah.
But like, think about...
But they're replaced so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess there's like a...
Well, there's a few that stick around, though. There's a few that stick around.
Yeah. I mean, actually, that raises another...
I'm not a mean
that
person.
Another question about like art as occasional or situational versus art as evergreen. So like... Hmm. You know, Amanda Gorman did that poem at the Biden inauguration, and many, many people were super moved by it. But like, will we be studying and reading that poem in 100 years? Maybe we will as history, but I don't know if we will at the, you know, because we want to understand poetry and the craft of poetry. And that's true for a lot of inaugural poems, or poems that are like commissioned for a particular event, is that the meaning or the utility of the poem is their ability to create a certain tone or certain mood for that moment. But that's different than this idea of like art speaking throughout generations, which is another angle that we haven't discussed as well.
Well, I know maybe we should be, but I think if on the first podcast, I'd said something, we're having this conversation on what is a classic, yeah. Remember? And the definition that I tried to provide was that if you, let's say, semantically have a sign, no, and that sign has a signifier and a signified, basically, a, let's say, a form and content, no? If let's say, if a Shakespeare or a Hölderlin or Homer Simpson or whatever, let's say transcends its own age, it transcends mostly as a in its form character. So what I mean is that Shakespeare, like take Macbeth, mm-hmm. No, it's been written 500 years ago, I think, or around 400 to 500. It's still resisting like a definite interpretation. So it survives through its form character, not through its content specifically, like, or better yet, it has become purely yeah. form, as is, yeah, and that's my point.
Well, I think
on the other hand, Vito,
well, I agree. So to map yeah. that onto our discussion, does art have utility? And if it does, how is that utility different than technologies? So I would say that a classic, if we go with your definition, a classic is something whose form lasts despite its content having a shelf life. Like, I don't need to know the historical context of England and Scotland to appreciate the story of, let's say, a man driven to madness by ambition, and so on. That's because yeah. content yeah. is attached to utility. Content is attached to the newspaper and saying what people around you need to hear. And form is attached to the eternal, and something that can translate across context. And so... ironically enough, like the way to become a classic is not to aspire to become a classic, but to aspire to doing something that is not captured by the moment or captured by the audience or captured by ideology. And if you do that, if you stay true to this idea of art having its own internal logic, then there's a good chance, a better chance that you'll get adopted than if you're just like writing the sermon that your congregation wants to hear that day?
I mean, to that point, like, I think that was the reasoning behind the origins of abstraction and abstract expressionism and the origins of the MoMA. It's and what we consider today like a gallery, a white cube. It's this is, you know, this is pure form. There is no, you know, yeah. You go in there as eyes.
I think though personally, like, I enjoy Cy Twombly's paintings and Jackson Pollock's and Roscoe's, but I'm not super optimistic that many of them will be classics, because I kind of feel like they're making a point and their form is a bit too content-y. It's a bit too finger waggy of like, don't be so representational. It's like, okay, yeah, we get the message. Whereas I actually feel that it's the paradoxical union of form and content that makes for a great work. So the fact that Shakespeare's plays have this historical dimension and also have this universal dimension together, that makes it moving, in part because we don't want to leave our time entirely. I think we want to be at the intersection of the particular and the universal, at least speaking for me personally.
As above, so below.
Like, and, I think representational that isn't merely representational is where I want to be. And so maybe then, just to tie it back to Cyrus's question, like, you kind of want to flirt with technology and art. You want to be sort of like, okay, you're not so functional, you're not so functionless, you're sort of flickering between the two. At least that's my own aesthetic. That's why I... And then we're talking about subjective and objective. So objective being like, is there a correct way to look at Elon Musk? Subjective being, or to look at Frankenstein. And a subjective would be, regardless of whether there's a correct way, like, how do you want to choose to look at the world? And there, I think maybe it's just a more beautiful way to live, to have an artistic lens on the world than to see everything through the lens of functionality. So that would be my recommendation to listeners, is it's so easy to get drawn into the use of something. Can you, even while using something, just take a few moments to step back and think about, what if this wasn't just a useful thing, but also a contemplative thing?
And then you have Frankenstein, which is, I don't know which of it. Against the goat.
So what do folks want to leave our listeners with after this conversation, this meditation on invention?
I didn't want to, ended up not doing it, but I was going to go into how it feels to act as an actor, how that work relates to the quote. And it is true that when you're a void and you have nothing to inspire you or to move you, it is very difficult to create a performance or, you know, when to create a performance and be in the moment. And it's when you have an influx of emotion or memories or prompts from, you know, say a director or the other actor across from you, that's when the idea starts flowing, the art comes out, and the performance happens. It's like a notebook. Example. It's like a notebook, like Francis from last week. The blank page is the void, but only thoughts come out if there's a chaos in the head. Same is true with the performance. That's my last.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. I was gonna say clean your room, you know, or something like this, but
that's good. That's the lightning bolt.
Yeah, exactly. Borrowed one.
What is invention?
Yeah,
clean your room.
I guess if I was to leave with a thought, it would be like, I think a lot of times we view our day in terms of productivity, and a byproduct of that is that we have to control it, right? Like we schedule, we like there's like this rigor almost. And I think that like the advice I would say, which I'm really giving to myself, if I'm being perfectly honest, is like wait out into the chaos. Like you have to kind of accept some part of that in your life in order to create and invent. And so I think for me, like my takeaway from today, one of them, because you guys are inspiring and brilliant, is to like just wait out into the chaos and see what kind of comes up instead of, you know, acting in such rigor and such order.
Nice. And mine is going to be similar to Anne's, but I'll just use slightly different terminology. I'll say shake out your heebie-jeebies. And on the other side is something so sweetly lyrical that only a song that only you could know.
A dream.
Thank you guys. Thanks everyone.
Thank you.